Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Black Ice by Lorraine Carey. Read by Lorraine Carey. To Laura Higgins Smith. Shall it any longer be said of the daughters of Africa, they have no ambition? Maria W. Stewart in The Liberator, 1831. There is a grace in life. Otherwise, we could not live. Paul Tillich, The Shaking of the Foundations. Skin, ya na know me? West Indian Folktale. June 1989. I could see them from the dais, family and friends sitting on the risers, young students spilling out onto the grass, black-robed faculty members standing in front of their seats, all watching for the first graduates to begin their march down the grassy aisle between the folding chairs on the green. Someone let out a whoop as they appeared, the girls in their white dresses and the boys in their jackets and ties. 15 years before, I had walked down the same aisle as a graduate and 9 years later as a teacher. Now I was ending my term as a trustee. I watched the black and Hispanic students, my kids, come to the podium to receive their diplomas and awards from the rector. One young man named Harlem winked at me as he passed. His shoulders still rocked a little, just a little, like the shoulders of black men in cities, and he held himself up on the balls of his feet like the ballet dancer he'd become while at St. Paul's School. I remembered him as a fourth former, his head cocked to one side, asking, "I'd like to know. Would you send your daughter to St. Paul's?" The other students had laughed in that way that teenagers do when an adult is forced to reveal herself. But we also laughed together as black people alone, safe for the moment within the group, the collective tensions and harmonic humor of it, relieved for an hour or so from our headlong rush toward individual achievement. "My daughter will have to decide that for herself," I said. "Don't roll your eyes. I mean it. My parents did not make me come here. I was bound and determined. They let me, and it was not an easy thing to do. It won't be the same for my daughter. Neither my parents nor I really knew what we were getting into. Once you've made the journey, you can't pretend it didn't happen, that everything's like it was before, except now you play lacrosse." I had pretended myself. Many of us had. I had acknowledged my academic debt to the boarding school I'd attended on scholarship for 2 years. But I would not admit how profoundly St. Paul's had shaken me, or how damaged and fraudulent and traitorous I felt when I graduated. In fact, I pretended for so long that by the time I was 26 years old, I was able to convince myself that going back to school to teach would be the career equivalent of summering with distant, rich relatives. Instead, I found my own adolescence in all its hormonal excess waiting for me at St. Paul's. Old rage and fear, ambition, self-consciousness, love, curiosity, energy, hate, envy, compulsion, fatigue. I saw my adolescence in my students, and I felt it burbling inside me, grown powerful by long silence. I lost control of it one night when a black boy came to me nearly weeping because a group of white friends had told a racist joke in his presence. He hated himself, he said, because he hadn't known how to react. It was like I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything, he said. I too had known that terrible paralysis, and when the boy left, I wept with remembering. I could no longer forget, nor with Westminster chimes ringing out the quarter hours, the piney mist that rolled off the pond in the morning, and the squeaking boards under our feet as we crossed upper common room to the dining room. I remember the self-loathing, made worse by a poised bravado as close as my own skin that I wore over it. I remembered duty and obligation to my family, to the memory of dead relatives, to my people. and I remembered confusion. Was it true that these teachers expected less of me than my white peers? Or had I mistaken kindness for condescension? Were we black kids a social experiment? If we failed or succeeded too well, would they call us off? Were we imported to help round out the white kids' education? Did it make any difference if we were? In the aftermath of Black is Beautiful, I began to feel black and blue, big and black and ugly. Had they done that to me? Had somebody else? Had I let them? Could I stop the feelings or hide them? I knew that I was to emerge from St. Paul's School changed, but I did not know how, and I did not trust my white teachers and guardians to guide me. What would this education do to me, and what was I to do with it? A couple years after I taught at St. Paul's, I was asked to serve as a trustee. During my term, I visited the school for board meetings, and I talked with the students. I could feel their attention one fall evening when I told them to try to think of St. Paul's as their school, too, not as a white place where they were trespassing. The next fall, a boy told me, I had been thinking of it as their school. It was like I have forgotten that this is my life. 2 years later, that boy's four mates elected him class president. At his graduation, Eric smiled broadly at me as he walked to the podium to receive the president's medal. So did a girl, an excellent and feisty writer, who was awarded the rector's medal. I wondered if they knew, or if they would learn, that just as St. Paul's was theirs because they had attended the school and contributed to it, so too was American life and culture theirs, because they were black people in America. Sitting on the dais, I recalled how wary I'd been of John Walker, the first black teacher at St. Paul's, its first black trustee, and the first black bishop of the Washington, D.C. Diocese of the Episcopal Church. I remembered watching him walk with the other board members and trying to deduce from his gait and the way he inclined his head whether the small man with the tiny eyes was traitor or advocate. He was still on the board during my tenure, a quiet-spoken man who affected people deeply by his presence. John Walker spoke wisely and from experience, but more than that, he emanated both judgment and compassion. I saw him affect my colleagues. I felt him. He filled me with hope for my own racial and spiritual healing and courage to look back. John Walker died in September 1989. I began writing about St. Paul's School when I stopped thinking of my prep school experience as an aberration from the common run of black life in America. The isolation I'd felt was an illusion, and it can take time, and as they say at St. Paul's, the love and labor of many, to get free of illusions. The narratives that helped me, that kept me company, along with the living, breathing people in my life, were those that talked honestly about growing up black in America. They burst into my silence and in my head. They shouted and chattered and whispered and sang together. I am writing this book to become part of that unruly conversation and to bring my experience back to the community of minds that made it possible. You must really love the school to be on the board. The students wanted to know each time I visited. Each time I answered yes. Did you like it when you were here? I made a sour face. They looked relieved. Chapter 1. I had never heard of St. Paul's School until Mrs. Evans rang to tell me about it one fall night in 1971. I'd just come home from Woolworths, where I worked at the cheap and greasy fountain on Friday nights and Saturdays in a town my friends and I called Tacky Darby. I smelled as if I had scrubbed the grill with my uniform. My face shone with hamburger fat, and my earth shoes were spattered. At 14 years old, I felt irritable and entitled to it. as adults seem to be when they finish their work for the day. Mrs. Evans' voice brimmed with excitement and fun. She was our next-door neighbor, a retired kindergarten teacher married to a newspaper reporter who had been the first black man on staff at the Philadelphia Bulletin. 3 years before, when I was 11, he had given me my first typewriter, a straight-back black Underwood. Mrs. Evans was witty and down-to-earth, firm but easygoing with children. Her eyesight was poor. She had a recurring tickle that caused her to clear her throat nearly to gagging. Under her shiny skin, her knuckles were gnarled. Yet she glowed with health. My father said that she had better legs than most 30-year-olds, and my mother asked her advice. My sister Carol ran away to the brick house, where a plaster Venus arose from her seashell, and dolphins leapt at half-moons in the cream-colored ceiling molding. It was a fairy tale house, and Mrs. Evans was a fairy godmother to us, distant and charming. I forgot that at first. Instead, I cradled the receiver on my shoulder and counted my tips while she talked, laying the coins silently on the kitchen counter. Mrs. Evans had been told about St. Paul's School by a lovely woman. I took that to mean someone white but trustworthy. This very exclusive boarding school had recently gone co-ed, and they were interested in finding black girls, too, so they'd put the word out with alumni and friends. Mrs. Evans had never visited the school, but she knew that the campus would be beautiful, that there would be music and languages and the arts. She also knew that scholarships, generous scholarships, were available. Mrs. Evans gave me the phone number of an alumnus, a judge, to call for more information. I wrote it down, thanked her for thinking of me, and went upstairs. I didn't need another school, I thought. I needed a bath. Later that night, despite my adolescent defiance, I could not help but think about what Mrs. Evans had said. This education was more than knowledge. It could mean credentials, self-confidence, power. I imagined living away from home, making a precocious launch into the wide world of competition. On Monday after school, I hurried home to call the judge, but when I got there, all I could do was stand next to the telephone preparing statements. My mother watched me as she cooked dinner. "Did Mrs. Evans give you the number to his home or his chambers?" she asked. I hadn't thought about chambers. Did chambers have telephones? I imagined a Dickensian suite of rooms, wood-paneled and dark. And in the middle, a big, florid man draped in black robes, pondering important papers. A man who was not used to being interrupted by phone calls from strange 14-year-old black girls who wanted to go to his alma mater. My mother laughed at me as I stood by the telephone in the kitchen staring at the number. "Just call him," she said. Wherever I rang, the judge didn't answer. A woman took the message and said he would get back to me. We got on with dinner preparation. Our TV blared, pots crackled, and dishes clattered. My parents talked over the TV. My 8-year-old sister talked over my parents. I talked over my sister. Then the telephone rang. By the time I had motioned wildly for silence, the conversation was nearly finished. The judge said that he was pleased to hear of my interest. Then he gave me the name and address of another alumnus would be hosting a meeting and urged me to attend. The meeting took place within a couple weeks. We drove through West Philadelphia, past the squat row houses where I had been raised, past the city center and then north, where Wissahickon Creek falls away from the road and woods rise up behind it. We were headed toward Chestnut Hill, more a place name than a place for me until then, a symbol of money and social exclusiveness. My father steered us through Germantown, where wet leaves lay in treacherous layers over trolley tracks and cobblestones. Cars slipped on and off the rails and then swerved to avoid each other, making rubbery squeals and muffled thuds. By the time we pulled into the stone driveway, I felt as if we were a long way from our home in the west end of Yaden, an enclave of black professionals, paraprofessionals, wish they was, look like, and might as well be professionals, as we called ourselves. We were far away from that black suburb, that As a West Philly transplant, I disliked for its self-satisfied smugness. When we'd moved from our city apartment, from the living room with the convertible couch where my parents slept, from the bedroom where my sister and I slept, which was transformed into a dining room at Christmas, and from the kitchen where we normally ate, and where my mother pressed and curled women's hair in the evenings, Yaden had impressed me with its leafy green grandeur and insularity. But now, as we stood in the Chestnut Hill driveway, I saw how modest our Tudors were, our semi-detached Dutch colonials, our muddy driveways, and the cyclone fences that held in our dogs. I saw it then with eyes made keen by years of witnessing our merciless self-criticism. "What's wrong with the colored race?" "I'll tell you what's wrong with the colored race. We don't think, that's what, and we don't stick together. And money? Forget it. Invest, get out of here. Now you take a look at the Jews, or you take the Chinese." I saw how consumed we've been with ambition and how modest had been our goals. Inside the stone house, in a large living room, we joined a few other black people who had also come to learn about the school. A boy who was younger than I sat next to his mother. When I said hello, he did not turn his head to look at me, but only peeped out of the corner of his eyes and nodded, as if we might bolt out of the house together and go howling into the Chestnut Hill woods if we were to look too hard at each other. His mother, her hair done up like Coretta Scott King's, sat still like her son. She looked as dignified as a picture on the back of a church fan, and just as inanimate. If she kept any unauthorized verb forms from flying out between her lips, she also held in any sign of life. Jeremy Price, this name and a few others have been changed, a black teacher from St. Paul's, tried a few times to make small talk, but he was a Brahmin from another planet. Cool, ironic, aloof. He was in his 30s, tweed jacketed and bearded, with a round belly. He touched his body lightly with his fingers, as if he were not used to his own girth. In every other way, he appeared absolutely smooth and easy to my adolescent eye, and assured to the point of arrogance. Mr. Price made quick judgments of us, they showed in his eyes. Clearly the pillar of the church lady with the southern coif and southern diffidence in the presence of white folks wasn't his type. Mr. Price seemed about to say something brutal to her. My father stepped in to ask if he could join them. The look she gave Daddy went beyond grateful to adoring. Women looked at my father that way. Their attention seemed to affect him as naturally as sunshine, and he never talked too much. "Still water runs deep," my great-grandmother had said about him when he came courting. She said so until she died. Men saw more ripples on the pond, which those of us who lived with him knew positively were caused by undertows. For one thing, when men exchanged the inevitable sports conversation, they discovered, as Mr. Price did, that my father was a student of judo. He'd spent 3 nights a week since his 28th birthday at the dojo. He had progressed from white belt to brown to black. We'd gone to competitions throughout the mid-Atlantic region, and I'd watched 3-minute dramas on the mat. Each time, he had to beat or be beaten. In contest after contest, he was a light middleweight whose feet made the sound of rushing as they swept the dry mat, and whose face turned purple when the last man, the one he finally could not beat, held him down, cutting into his windpipe with his bleached white gi. In those moments, when I prayed that he would not be killed in some fluke throw, I saw in his eyes a concentration and force that made life with us in the sparkling 3-room apartment seem like some errant choice. He was, above all, a physical being, a wiry man who once tied our deluxe-sized refrigerator to his back to move it, and would probably not object to being remembered that way. We three, 2 girls and a woman, surrounded him with doll babies and crisscross curtains. It was like watching a carnivore sit down to porridge each night. Dad had first seen judo practiced in a 1945 film, Blood on the Sun, with James Cagney. Intended as an anti-Japanese propaganda, the film showed an expansionist culture, arrogant and absolute. Daddy loved it. Judo. There was a vision of power, mental, physical, spiritual, beneath a placid exterior. It was nearly 20 years before my father stepped onto a mat. Now he needed only to mention the word. People looked at him as if he had jumped out of a samurai movie. Even Mr. Price lost his frost when the subject came up. As I watched the two of them chat, my fear of Mr. Price dissipated, but not my wariness. He did not quite seem one of us. Mike Russell did. He was a St. Paul School senior recruiting black candidates as an independent study project, and he had more poise than I'd ever seen in a teenager. His skin was chocolatey and fine-pored, and his bottom lip pouted like Sidney Poitier's. He was sleek and articulate. He paid attention to me. I crossed my legs with what I hoped was lithe grace and stretched my neck until I nearly pitched forward onto the floor. I wanted to know the things he must know about science and literature and language, living away from home, New England, white people, money, power, himself. I supposed that the other black students at St. Paul's must have had Russell's sophistication and charm, his commitment to black progress. I had to be part of that. With the force of religious conversion, the great God of education moved within me, an African Methodist God with a voice that boomed like thunder. It took all my strength to hold myself inside my skin. This school, why, this was what I'd been raised for, only I hadn't known it. They closed the curtains and turned off the lights for the slideshow. I hoped that my face had not betrayed me. Russell narrated the slideshow. He told us about the old chapel, a steepled red brick church, and towering behind it on the green lawn, the chapel of St. Peter and St. Paul, built in 1886 to accommodate a larger student body, and enlarged in 1927. The new chapel was massive. Its brick and stone walls were heavy and stolid, and yet its stained glass windows seemed infinitely light, as if they could almost float up to the heavens. We saw other buildings as well, the schoolhouse, student houses. In keeping with the school's family-centered lexicon, they were not to be called dormitories. The rectory, the funny circular post office, and special academic buildings for science, math, and art. The gray granite library with its white columns had been built by somebody famous. It sat at the edge of yet another pond, casting a wavering, silvery reflection on the water. Over and over again, we saw these buildings draped with scenic young people, alone or in small groups, talking, laughing, bending their heads toward one another, or running together on a green field in some pantomime of benevolent competition. I saw black boys. I saw girls, a few of them black, too. And I saw them all in a brilliant medley of New Hampshire seasons. At one point in the slideshow, Russell flashed through the carousel to find a misplaced slide, creating an intoxicating display of colors, autumn red and gold, winter snowy blue-white, spring green and pink and blue, so sharp and bright that they seemed to originate not on the screen, but from deep inside my head, like music. Mr. Price's voice, clear and insouciant, brought me back to myself. He was asking for someone to open the drapes. My mother began with a question about the progress of coeducation. First there were tea dances, Mr. Price said, begun in the 19th century and carried forward into the 1960s as dance weekends. Girls were bussed in, talked to, danced with, and then bussed out again. He looked at Mike Russell and asked ironically, "How were they?" Russell shook his head and laughed. "They were awful." Mr. Price went on. In 1969 and 1970, girls came, like foreigners, to participate in a winter term exchange. The next winter, the first 19 came to stay. What was a tea dance? I wondered. Tea meant little girls with clean hands and faces sipping out of china cups, eating butter cookies with raspberry jam. Teas belonged in church or in childhood. A dance, to the contrary, meant teenagers in a basement. Black lights, red bulbs, music jamming its way through our shoes and up into our feet. It meant arms in the air, whistles, a soul train down the middle of the room, whipping out new steps nice and casual, as if we hadn't spent all week practicing. It meant sweat steaming out of the tops of our heads, shrinking afros worthy of Angela Davis down to dreaded TWA's teeny-weeny afros. A dance meant watching sharp so that no amorous brother spoiled our hot pants. Tea had nothing to do with it. Mr. Price acted as cultural interpreter for us, as if a bank of white and black computers stood on either side of him, bleeping away in incompatible languages. When my mother asked about the grading system, I heard her asking whether white teachers 400 miles away would give her kid a fair grade. Hanging in the air was our fear that they'd let us survive, but never excel. Mr. Price answered by describing the system. High honors for work that was truly outstanding, honors for work that was very, very good, high pass, he laughed and shook his head, was a great gray muddy area between the very good and the okay. Pass was just acceptable, and unsatisfactory was self-explanatory. Then he estimated how many students received which grades, and quite directly said it right out in this white alumnus's house with the costly furnishings, told us how the black students were doing. He said most of them were working hard, but some were not, frankly, getting what the school had to offer. He did not answer the black mother's fear of their children's powerlessness, their vulnerability to white adults who might equate sharpness of mind with sharpness of features. Mr. Price encouraged Russell to comment. Mike told a few stories about himself, portraying St. Paul's as a place where well-meaning, well-trained teachers tried hard to live up to their calling. Some, he added meaningfully, were more sensitive than others. Then my mother told a story about a science award I had won in the third grade. She started with the winning, the long white staircase in the auditorium of the Franklin Institute, and how the announcer called my name twice because we were way at the back, and it took me so long to get down those steps. Mama's eyes glowed. She was a born raconteur, able to increase the intensity of her own presence and fill the room. She was also a woman who seldom found new audiences for her anecdotes. So she made herself happy, she insisted, with us children, her mother, her sisters, her grandparents, an entire clan of storytellers competing for a turn on the family stage. This time, all eyes were on my mother. Her body, brown and plump and smooth, was shot through with energy. This time, the story had a purpose. She told them how my science experiment almost didn't get considered in the citywide competition. My third grade teacher, angry that I'd forgotten to bring a large box for displaying and storing the experiment, made me pack it up to take home. Our teacher had told us that the boxes were needed to carry the experiments from our class to the exhibition room, and she'd emphasized that she would not be responsible for finding 30 boxes on the day of the fair. Without a box, the experiment would have to go home. Other kids, white kids, had forgotten boxes during the week. They'd brought boxes the next day. I asked for the same dispensation, but was denied. The next day was the fair, she said. That was different. I came out of school carrying the pieces of the experiment my father had picked out for me from a textbook. This was a simple buoyancy experiment where I weighed each object in the air and then in water to prove that they weighed less in water. I had with me the scale, a brick, a piece of wood, a bucket, and a carefully lettered poster. Well, my mother marched me and my...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?